Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's The Wonky Show. We're talking the latest research on student academic experience, postgrads, the reorganising of Whitehall Science, and a report on white working class students. It's all coming up.
My worry, if you like, is that the pandemic has delayed adulthood either further, and that means the response from universities needs to be even greater than currently planned, because we're going to have students who are coming into universities or have just moving into second years who are...
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, and here to help us survey the world of HE policy this week are three brilliant guests. In Cambridge, we have Jonathan Grant, Professor of Public Policy at King's and Director of Different Angles. Jonathan, your hire for the week, please.
I participated in a UKRI roundtable on the future of research impact assessment, which I found incredibly stimulating because we're sort of getting beyond the old tropes and sort of getting into some quite interesting spaces.
And in York, we've got Marion Hilditch, Deputy Academic Registrar at the University of Bradford and Chair of SROC. Marion, your highlight of the week.
I'd very much like to say it's the end of Pride Month, but actually it has been quite an abysmally bad Pride Month. So instead I'm going to say it was seeing Brenda Romero speak yesterday about the women's leadership, which was a very inspiring and also infuriating talk.
And in somewhere in the southwest, no one knows quite where, it's David Kernahan, that's DK to you and me. DK, your highlight of the week?
A couple, really. I got a chance to speak to a bunch of learning technologists at ALT and a bunch of quality assurance professionals with the QAA, and I would struggle to think of any two groups of people that have done more to make the last year work. Mm-hmm. So it was great to catch up with them.
So let's start the week with the latest research out from HEPI and Advanced HE, the annual Student Academic Experience Survey. Marion, talk us through it.
So yes, the freshly released Student Academic Experience Survey for 2021 by HEPI Advanced HE surveyed about 10,000 full-time undergraduate students between February and March 2021. Non-surprisingly, perhaps the results are not very positive compared to last year. Students have not had the experience they were expecting. And I say not very surprising, but it doesn't mean that it's good news in any way or that we should just take it for granted that this is all down to COVID and move on. So some of the key findings of the report is contact hours have declined compared to the previous year. Again, perhaps not surprisingly, although also students have found that their actual assessments have risen. Many students find that they would repeat this year as they have done, but then we've also got about 1 in 10 that say that they would have deferred. About 1 in 3 consider leaving their course, but the shocking finding out of this is that that actually rises up to 43% for disabled students. And even more shockingly, perhaps again not surprisingly, is that this has risen up to 64% for trans students. Again, this is up from the previous year by about 13%. We've also got at the same time the release of the Accenture and Sybil report on the student mental health higher education, which was conducted in late 2020. And again, not surprisingly, we are told that students have not been having a good time with this year. A lot of them have reported not having a single friend at university. And a lot of them have reported mental health issues either that have come about this year or long-term mental health issues, issues that have been exacerbated. And again, this report picks out LGBTQ students and the disproportionate impact this is having on them.
So it's pretty mixed and some troubling reading. DK, can you help us find some of the good news in the research?
Well, I mean, every year we get this survey and every year we hope to learn something from the survey to take on to future years. I mean, this is the point of surveying students about their experiences, to keep getting better. Unfortunately, a big chunk of what we've learned this year is that it's not a good idea to study at higher education level during a pandemic. In terms of good news, students are less anxious than I expected. They're still pretty anxious, but they're as anxious as they were in 2014. I did mention this to Jim Dickinson, and he says that was a difficult time. The proportion that would leave HE entirely that are just so hacked off with the experience that they've just got no interest in HE study. It's the same as in 2018. What we've seen in 2021 is a rise in the number of students that are thinking that they wish they had deferred the start of their course, which, although it's not great for those students and their experience, it does get through the message that fundamentally, underneath all of this, higher education is still attractive and it's still something students want to do. But on the face of it, it's been a horrible year. It's been a year that students should not have been subjected to, should not have had to deal with. And it does, I know it's the UCU talking point, but I think in this case, it's the right one. It does point the finger at government. These students should never have gone back to campus, and there should have been some other measures in place.
It's interesting because the value for money scores is what's getting the headlines in the press, because those have done really, really poorly this year compared to previous years. Jonathan, I mean, does that speak to what we'd actually call value for money, or is that about what happened before the term in the year started? Is that about that expectation management of what, you know, the kind of gap between what people expected to get and what they got?
Yeah, so, well, I think you could say yes to both of those points, and that's half the challenge with this data. It did occur to me that, you know, and this isn't about being trite, but I've had no value for money for my car insurance over the last year. So there is a degree that this is inevitable, given the situation that we as a sector found ourselves in, and I absolutely support DK's comment about sort of lack of clarity from government at the beginning of the year. I had a quick look at the data and I couldn't see a breakdown by first year, second year, third year. It may well be there, but I do think we've also got to remember that those first year students went through the A-level fiasco as well. And that must be having some kind of impact.
Just to break in there, there is actually a breakdown that I know Nick Hillman would be delighted that I'm picking up on this and making sure that we hear it. The interesting thing, I tend to look at the overall, is the experience what you expected? Question that just seems like a more reliable question for me. The ones who have really struggled are the ones in their final year, in their third or their fourth or above year. I think in talking about University of the Press, we do tend to think about freshers in halls and just starting their careers and Freshers Week and all that stuff. But in terms of the reality of doing your exams, doing your assessed work, especially in practical subjects, and trying somehow to look for a graduate job in a very uncertain economy, I think those have really been the students that have struggled, and that does come through in the data.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting, isn't it, DK? Because, you know, so I guess my headline sort of response to that is that we should not be surprised that students felt they were not getting value for money, because I think you could argue that right across all other sectors. But I don't think that is an excuse for either government or the sector in the way that we have reacted. And we do need to learn those lessons. And I think the real take-home message for me is on the mental health issues that came up in the second survey.
Yeah, absolutely. That was not a great survey for the sector. There has been a rash of reports over in previous years about the phenomenon of student loneliness. Of course, our very own Jim Dickinson kicked off first report at the original Secret Life of Students event, and look forward to future news about Secret Life in student events to come soon from Wonky. So they found 55% of students reported they felt lonely every day or every week, which on the face of it is scary. It's slightly worse than the previous time they ran it in 2019. The question was, how often have you felt lonely in the last 12 months? And the options were daily, weekly, monthly, once, twice, on never. So it's kind of an impressionistic thing. And as we know, unfortunately, with mental health experiences, one of the symptoms, the things that you get if you suffer from depression, as many, many people have in the sector and continue to do so, is there is a tendency to report things as being worse than they actually are, because they feel worse to you and they look and you experience them worse. So there is an issue there that if students are having a horrible time anyway, then they could report things worse. The difference between this and 2019 is not much. It's 11 percentage points. Students are more lonely this year, but that's not as much as you might expect if it was wholly to do with the pandemic. There is a fundamental issue with students and mental health, which is something that we've covered on the site recently as well. And again, this, the pandemic is not a get out of jail free card for the sector here. We have serious work to do.
So, Marion, what's to be done for September?
Yeah, quite rightly, I think we need to look forward. So hopefully a lot of institutions, I know certainly at Bradford, we have spent a lot of time thinking how we're going to support students who are coming back from this experience, and have spent a lot of time thinking about the additional academic support that we can provide them, and also mental health support and financial support, actually. And I should hope that this is something that the sector all over has been looking at, because we need to acknowledge that the experience that students have had has been different. We've all worked very hard to do our best, but it has been in most cases just that, doing our best. And I also wanted to go back a little bit to what we're talking about final year students, and point out that these students are not going to get to experience a graduation, and actually the students before them didn't either. So most universities have switched online ceremonies. So I hope that we all get to do something for those students so they can actually have the big celebration that they rightly deserve when we are in a position to do that. So it's not just about the students that are still with us, it's also about the students that have already completed with us, and not forget about them. But I think mental health support is key. Academic support is key. But also, I think it's lessons learned. One of the findings is that some of the comments have been around the fact that students have found actually deadlines have too many clashes in their assessments now. And that's definitely a lesson learned for us, because by pivoting from exams to online assessment, we may not have gotten it very right in coordinating those deadlines, and we can definitely work on that and do better. So there's a lot that we can do to learn from the experience. And personally, actually, these findings are hard to read, but they could have been much worse. So obviously we have done something right. I think, again, should not forget that this is not the same experience for all the students that we're talking about. So some of these students have spent the majority of the year at home. Some of them have spent a lot of the year trapped in halls of residence. Some of them have spent it on the NHS front lines. And what are we going to do to support those students as well? There's students who should have been on placements in healthcare that have not been able to have those placements at all. It's not a straightforward issue. There's a lot of work to do. And I think the key thing is to acknowledge what's happened and work together to do better.
Jonathan, that acknowledgement is pretty important, though, isn't it? Because the line that comes from some places, which is, you know, it's essentially, well, of course, you know, things weren't great. It was a pandemic. It doesn't, you know, it's going to be hard to rebuild from that, because you've got to listen to what students are telling you. And, you know, at the same time, lots of promises were made about how things were going to be okay and equivalent and everything else, with the best of intentions. But at the same time, kind of the experience is the experience. And just a supplementary kind of question, the political bind that the government could push the sector into this year, it's really awkward timing, but it looks very likely the government's going to also do something to the graduate repayment threshold and make it, you know, make this cohort of students pay more for longer potentially. And that's going to give universities an even harder time in the next couple of years, isn't it? Because students don't care what the kind of government policy is or how it's helping or not helping their experience at university. It's the kind of, you know, it's the provider. It's the contact. It's the, you know, it's everything that happens within that experience from kind of the opening the prospectus to graduating. It feels to me that the government are going to really squeeze universities in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I wholly agree with that, Mark. And I think it's going to be a very challenging, to horrendous word, time for everybody. And, you know, to a degree, that's why I think universities have to, as a sector, step up and own the issue. One of the places, just going back to Marion's comments around mental health, I think I absolutely agree with Marion. We've got to think about the sort of diversity of experience when we talk about student experience and mental health, because it is very varied for very different reasons. But I also think it's really important that we acknowledge that this increase in mental health or mental ill health, as we probably should call it, predated the pandemic. And there's lots of both sort of clinical research on that, but also socio-demographic research, trying to provide explanations of the increase in mental in health around young people. And that one of the, in my mind, one of the best explanations for that is this increase in so-called delayed adulthood. And my worry, if you like, is that the pandemic has delayed adulthood either further. And that means the response from universities needs to be even greater than currently planned, because we're going to have students who are coming into universities or have just moving into second years who are in a sort of psychological sense younger than they were a generation ago. But the constructs by which we support those students haven't radically changed in that period. So I really think there's an opportunity for quite radical change in thinking about how we support students from a mental well-being as well as mental ill health perspective.
As kind of a counterpoint almost, there is clearly a mental health issue around young people more generally, and in particular we see it among students. And it surprises and kind of morbidly fascinates me that this is happening at the same time as the arm of the free speech debate that says education needs to be challenging, it needs to put students in uncomfortable places. Well, we've had a little test of this year. We've put students in uncomfortable places, and surprise, surprise, it is not good for them. So, I mean, maybe the people that are making those kind of arguments about free speech need to possibly rethink their positions a little.
Yeah, no, I wholly agree. You know, all this sort of language of coddling snowflakes is both disrespectful, but it the data doesn't really back it up. And you know, I think as a sector, as you know, as governments, if you like, we've got to acknowledge that these Gen Z students have a very different set of values, and it's not just Gen Z students; it's Gen Z non-students as well. And you know, the explanations for that can be debated. But the fact is that we have seen an increase in mental ill health. And when you look at the data, that can't be explained by diagnostic biases and things like that. And one of the explanations is this concept of delayed adulthood, which I think lands firmly in the remit of universities and how they support students as they go through their undergraduate education. And I don't think we've adapted our structures within universities to deal with that.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, this is Andy Fippin. I'm Professor of Digital Rights at Bournemouth University, and today's article, The Kid in Wonky, which I co-authored with Professor Emma Bond and Professor Graham Towle, looks at what the university response to the recent Ofsted report about sexual harassment in schools should be about. So while Ofsted obviously is focused on schools, I think what there's fundamental messages that come out of it that relate very strongly to the Office of Student Statement of Expectations around sexual harassment and misconduct in university environments. And we think the most fundamental message that we can take from the Ofsted report is the statement that institutions should acknowledge that this does go on, rather than worrying about whether or not it does. We think institutions should take a position that they will assume sexual harassment, misconduct and assault is happening on campus, and provide measures to support students who might be victims of those sorts of things, because we know the main reason victims don't disclose is because they don't think they're going to be believed, and they don't think anything will happen if they do disclose. So the fundamental thing we think universities should be looking at is providing clear routes for disclosure and support by trained staff via those routes for disclosure, and also obviously to very clearly signpost those routes for disclosure to all students.
Okay, the Sutton Trust has a new report out on postgrads. DK, talk us through the highlights, please.
Okay, so this is called inequality in the highest degree, which I imagine something that somebody at the Sutton Trust is very proud of. Essentially, it situates access to postgraduate study, to master's level study, as a new front or an increasingly important front in the battle to widen access and ensure that anyone that can benefit from university education gets to do so. So back in 2013, 2014, 6% of what we call working class students did a master's going on from their degree, 8.6 from managerial and professional backgrounds. If we scroll forward to 2017-18, that's 12.9% of working class students and 14.2% of managerial and professional background students. So this, we link obviously to the success of fee loans, but unlike fee loans in the undergraduate space, the amount of the loan is not tied to the amount that's charged in fees. So we've seen a lot of inflation regarding postgraduate fees. So in 2011, if you wanted to do a master's in the Russell Group, you're looking at paying about £4,400. In 2020, you're looking at a 98% increase in fees, 8,700 or thereabouts, which is a big expansion. It's above inflation. And the concern is, even though we have this support available, if we hike the prices up even further, then we're just getting the same problems as we had previously, apart from we're spending twice as much government money, which is probably a bad thing. It's a good report. I recommend you take a look at it, and we've got a piece on the site as well.
It's, I mean, nothing there that's going to particularly surprise anybody. I mean, it's very expensive. There are lots of barriers to participating. And one of the things that's troubling is kind of it's also the pipeline, isn't it, for the sector. So, you know, I mean, it's the next phase, or really it's the start, the postgraduate level, really the start of most people's academic career in kind of traditionally as it was. And there is a problem, isn't there, coming out? I mean, Jonathan, I wonder whether universities need to be thinking about this in terms of, you know, their own talent pipeline.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, as you say, it's very hard to, you know, I don't mean there's much in here that surprises us. To a degree, you could take a positive spin on this, because the gap has narrowed between so-called working class graduates and those from a more managerial background, which, you know, has got to be a reasonably good thing. But diversity within academia, on all dimensions of diversity, has got to be absolutely crucial for the sector going forward. And, you know, and I think the question is, what do we mean by diversity in that context? And obviously, the background of academics is critical. But also, I would argue, and have argued in other places, that we also need to think about bringing people into academia who have not traditionally followed an academic route, and to diversify views like that as well. And, you know, I suspect that's going to be an ever-increasing trend as we go forward.
Mm. I mean, how do you frame this in your university, Marion? Do you encourage people to keep progressing despite all these barriers?
Oh, of course. It's what we do, Mark. We encourage people to keep progressing and studying with us. Yes. And again, I think we need to be a bit mindful about the sort of blanket views of what postgraduate study looks like. And I think the point here made around postgraduate loans is interesting. That it does cover some of the costs, but not all of them. And also, I want to point out that it's quite an inflexible scheme as well. And we know that, yes, in principle, it's been a force for good, allowing more people to enter postgraduate education. But actually, the way that it has been implemented has been perhaps rather simplistic at times, and difficult to manage from a university's end. So I think more thought needs to be put into how we enable. And I know that there is a longer term view of how we fund adults as well to carry on studying, that is going to look at the loan system. I think it is something really important that needs to be looked at in conjunction to everything else. But certainly universities are doing their best to encourage students to carry on studying with them, or to, you know, not necessarily even with them, to carry on studying in general, and to attract more students into postgraduate programs.
If I two comments on that, because I agree with Marion, and I think one of the, so clearly there's a financing bit here, which does need to be addressed and become more flexible. And the sort of noises you get is that's sort of kind of on the agenda, I guess. But it seems to me that universities also need to respond to a degree, and some are doing this very much. But, you know, when you look at sort of postgraduate education, lifelong learning, you need alternative models, which sort of bring in sort of micro credits, and credit transfer systems, quite quickly. And if we could start to, you know, especially coming out of the pandemic where we've seen a shift into online education, there's real opportunities in there to start creating frameworks for both credit transfer, but also microcredits, which you can build up over, say, a 10-year period. And I think there's quite a lot of innovation in that space that we could start to move into.
The problem with the proposals on lifelong learning is they are explicitly dealing with level 4 to level 6 qualifications. So up to the level of your honours undergraduate degree, your standard undergraduate degree. I've not seen any discussion in that debate about the idea of master study. The skills gap in the UK is not so much at level 4 and level 5, but is actually at level 7 and above. Increasingly, postgraduate qualifications are something that's expected if you are starting, a professional, career outside of academia as well as inside academia. There's a lot of interest in employers in having their employees come back and do, postgraduate, courses as well. And it does feel like we're kind of missing the trick in the, post-16 education and skills bill, that we're not dealing at all with postgraduate study in there.
Although, I mean, it speaks to a sector solution, though, doesn't it? I mean, the few people in the sector would probably want MPs to start legislating on how to organise postgrad courses.
I would imagine not, but I imagine that we would like a more sensible and more sustainable solution on funding for postgraduates, because all that we've seen happen, unfortunately, with the loan coming in, is prices have eventually gone up, which just leaves us with the same problem of inequity. You still effectively need to have private resources in order to study at a master's level, and it's pretty much essential to become an academic, and that just feels like a waste of talent.
And now it's time to catch up with Mike Ratcliffe and the hidden history of higher education.
I think one of the things about university history is that we've always had it. We've always been interested in the previous history and what's been going on. So my favourite little bit is the fight between Oxford and Cambridge to be the oldest. So they set off, and the historians know that there's learning happening all over the place, and slowly it coalesces into universities. But we know that Cambridge gets a big shot in the arm when there's a big riot in Oxford, and sufficient students and lecturers go over to Cambridge and get it going, and it's 1209 and it's fine, and off they go. But that sets up a precedence that clearly if people left Oxford to go to Cambridge, then Oxford must be older than Cambridge. But all of the kind of precedence sits on who's the oldest university. So they get to the 17th century, and this isn't enough. So you get this battle between these mad antiquarians as to who can be the oldest university. And they start producing books. So, I mean, it's great, referable stuff. And they start making up quotes in order to guarantee that my university is older than your university. So Oxford kind of kicks off by saying that it was founded by King Alfred. So that puts it about 400 years older than it ought to be. But King Alfred founds it, and they find a quote that a guy sticks into a translation of Asser's Life of Alfred, saying that St. Grimble came over to found the University of Oxford, and he just puts it in this edition of the book. And it's completely bogus, but he just shoves it in. So that proves that Oxford is founded around 800, so that makes it, you know, nice and old. But then, in a next edition, they decide that that's not enough, so they find an even older quote, and that says that Grimble didn't found it, he reformed it, and that it had been founded 400 years earlier than that by a bunch of Anglo-Saxon saints, and they list all those saints out, and that's all very nice, and so they got a list of these people, and so they're much older, so clearly they managed to push that back. And why is that? Well, Cambridge has meantime gone and found that they've been founded by someone called Cantabers, and he's been helped by King Arthur, so that pushes them earlier than King Alfred. So They've been founded by King Arthur, and King Arthur's gone and found Athenian philosophers to come over, and he's made his university, and they're, so they're much older than Oxford. So clearly there's then a reaction, and so Oxford seems to trump the entire thing by coming up with this ruse, and it coalesces with the idea that England must be really old and ancient. It can't just be, you know, an accident of successive waves of people invading it. So they were founded by the Trojans, who had escaped the siege of Troy, and they'd sailed around the Mediterranean, and they had arrived, and they'd set up the University of Oxford. And to deal with the fact that there's a small issue of there not being any Greek temples in Oxford, to prove that it's actually, you know, founded 2,000 years before Christ, they add this extra embellishment that it was burned down by the Romans. So they're so old that they were burned down by the Romans. So this backwards and forwards in order to get precedence produces these books. So each of the universities has a published book that lists their history up to the conquest, 1066. We know that the universities could not have been in existence until at least 100 years after. But these guys have produced these fabulous books saying, we're so old that we've been going for so long.
So, there's been a reorganisation of science in Whitehall this week. Jonathan, talk us through it.
Well, to be honest, Mark, it's as clear as clotted cream as from what I've read. So, if you look at the sort of press release coming out in number 10, two things are going to happen. There's going to be a new council to set up strategy on how science and technology will tackle the great societal challenges and transform lives. Their language, not mine. And again, in their language, plans set to build on the success of the best UK science throughout the pandemic and beyond to cement the UK's position as a science superpower. I think the particular policy developments in all of this are the development of this new council for science and technology that will be headed by the chief scientific advisor, Patrick Vallance. The clotted cream comment is that we already have a Council for Science and Technology. This one is a Council for Science and Technology Strategy. So the sort of lines between those two at this stage, at least, are pretty unclear to me. I think the consequence of these policies is pretty muted, if I'm honest about it. But I think there are some issues that universities probably need to think through to a degree. The first is there's a complete absence of mention of the arts, humanities and social sciences in any of this. So it does seem yet again a quite a technocratic response coming from number 10. And you can see the whole debate around the role of the arts and humanities and ARIA being repeated in this context. I think it does yet again raise the long-term challenge to the where the research actually occurs for universities. So we've got this commitment to increase R&D across the sector, but there's no commitment necessarily that that will occur in universities. And related to that, I think you're going to see more directed research and more erosion of the Haldane principle, which is a phrase that we haven't heard for a number of years now. And that may well make universities uncomfortable. So they're going to have to sort of square, if you like, those tensions.
And by that, you mean the sort of reorientating things a bit further towards kind of ministerial direction?
Yes. So less sort of ideas coming from the academic sector and more we want to create a vaccine, which in the context of a pandemic makes a lot of sense. But the success of that is going to direct a whole lot of other challenges. And that will have quite knock-on effects within the research system and what research will be funded and what won't be funded. And then I guess my final deeply cynical comment is it's amazing how chief scientific advisors can create new jobs because the previous chief scientific advisor, Mark Woolpot, created UKRI and this current one has now created a new Office for Science and Technology Strategy. And I guess, you know, related to that, what is the relationship between this new office and UKRI? Again, gets back to my clotted cream.
I guess the most cynical reading of it is that it's a kind of Whitehall exercise in moving things around, dismantling all the kind of institutions and architecture that's going to come under scrutiny up in the big public inquiry about what happened in COVID. So in the same way with they've done in kind of NHS and Public Health England and the rest, the big reorganisation. So the people, the institutions are all going to not be standing when the criticism comes. And not, you know, it's going to be tough to hold anyone responsible.
Yeah, that, and yes, and James Alston made that comment on Twitter when it all came out, and I'm quite sympathetic with that. But to a degree, I don't think that, from a sort of science policy and science funding perspective, I don't think that matters too much. I think the real question is, how does this impact on delivering that aspiration of getting to 2.4% GDP and science funding, and post-Brexit science funding? And so will we see the increase in science funding? What is the nature of that increase? Will it be mission-oriented or funded through the research councils? And will that research funding land in universities or in other places? So I think those are the three fundamental issues, rather than the reorganisation of the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Yeah. But we're talking about, I mean, DK, this is still the kind of influence of Dominic Cummings over science policy, right?
So, backwards and a forwards and a backwards, he's the kind of geezer who likes to muscle in. It was true when the Shaman said it in 1992, and it's equally true as I say it today in 2021. Science policy has become, after a fair time in the backwaters of departmental life, it's been brought back to the centre of government. Of course, there actually used to be an Office for Science and Technology in the Cabinet Office back in the 90s, and things gradually moved out until we ended up with somebody like Amanda Soloway in charge of science policy, an appointment as unlikely as it is puzzling, I think it's fair to say. So science policy at the moment, for whatever reason, is fashionable, is glamorous. There hasn't been any fundamental changes as to who actually decides science policy in terms of what research is actually performed. That's still researchers who bid to funding competitions that are assessed by peer review. ARIA slightly queers that pitch by adding in whatever metric they're going to use to fund research. What's interesting to me is that it's explicitly bringing in technology as well as science. I kind of, if I hear technology in government speeches, I think of applied science and science that is quite a lot further down the funnel to commercial exploitation. So that seems to be coming in the same way as Ukraine now, in swallowing up Innovate UK, has a role further down the pipeline as well. And even the text of the ARIA bill suggests is we're looking a lot closer to productizing science, which is interesting. I finally note that Patrick Vallance has become Boris Johnson's technical advisor, which I believe was a role last held by Jennifer Akuri. So, I mean, that's perhaps one to conjure with. Maybe not the kind of job he was hoping for.
A new report out from the House of Commons Education Committee talked about participation of white working class students this week and triggered a cavalcade of culture war stories in the media quite dispiritingly. But there's some really important points here. Marianne, talk us through them.
Yes, so Mark, quite rightly. So this is the report by the House of Commons Education Committee that calls, among other things, for the Office of Students to set some targets for the participation of white working class students, notably not white working class boys, but all white working class students. The report is called The Forgotten, and how white working class pupils have been let down, and it covers achievement throughout the school system all the way up to entering to higher education. And important to note that working class here has been measured through a free school meal participation, which is sort of a bit of a proxy. And the report acknowledges that this is not a perfect measure. And it touches on things like school-based initiatives and encourages for the take-up of apprenticeships and degree apprenticeships, various other recommendations. And it really is hard not to... It's hard not to be sarcastic about the report, sadly, because the topic at hand is important, and we need to talk about it, and we need to look at how we're leaving white working class students behind. Sadly, the report, as you say, Mark, sort of like undermines its own credibility, unfortunately, right from its own introduction, by saying that we need to stop talking about white privilege. and how unhelpful this is. And sure, it is unhelpful. As a, you know, white working class person in this country, perhaps the last thing you feel is privileged. And telling you that you are is not helpful in any way. But I do fail to see how that's the thing that's actually discouraging you from doing better at school and going to university. And I think we've got bigger problems here. And the report's recommendations, some of them are good things to look at. We absolutely should look at them, and we absolutely need to make sure that we are addressing the issue. But it makes itself less to be taken less seriously, let's say, by how it's approaching the subject at hand. And I think I'll try not to be any more negative about it.
DK, find us something useful from it though.
I find something useful for it. It's like all policy, it's a problem of data definition. There is a marvelous article on Wonky by my esteemed colleague Matt Grogan called "Who Exactly Is This White Working Class?" And in it, he talks about the problems of saying, okay, everyone thinks they know what they mean when they say white working class rhetorically. They think they know what they're talking about. But in practice, actually coming up with a definition to see this group in the data is quite complex. Now, what the Education Committee have done, they've used eligibility for free school meals, the usual free school meal marker, which I think is any instance of free school meals in the past 6 years. And they've looked at an intersection of that and a white ethnicity. Now, I'm all in favor of intersectional data measures. We can learn a lot about pockets of deprivation, problems that we can see a way to address among quite small groups. But here, the issue is that free school meals are the marker is such a powerful indicator of educational disadvantage, social disadvantage, employment disadvantage, any disadvantage you can name, basically, that the fact that these young people happen to be white is not necessarily the reason they're disadvantaged. The other issue that this, and this isn't quite a positive, unfortunately, Mark, sorry about this, is that it is, as the Conservatives used to say about the Labour Party, it is the politics of envy. If we're looking at this as a problem, it's not necessarily that anyone has ever denied that children from disadvantaged backgrounds have had problems in accessing higher levels of education. That is the case, and there's a lot of work, a lot of really valuable and worthwhile work that is going on to do that. It is the perception that we need white working class people to be envious of working class people of other ethnicities because supposedly they're getting more help from the government. They're not. There's no such thing as targeted by ethnicity. It is a target in the Office for Students Access and Participation Plans, but it's not something that like people are sitting here and saying our campus is hideously white, which a lot of campuses in quite diverse places are. But the answer is let's expand, let's bring in more students rather than let's not bring in white students. So it's like an imagined kind of Daily Express problem as opposed to an actual issue that we need to be spending time over. We do need to be getting better at providing access to higher level of education for all students. We need to be working with schools. We need to be working with local groups. That higher education already does a lot of this. We've seen some improvements over the last decade or so. There is a lot more to do, but this kind of stuff, it's just not a helpful intervention, and that's the problem because it so easily could have been.
There is still a challenge there for universities, Jonathan. I mean, it's a tricky area for people to talk about because it brings us back to race and all sorts of tricky things that the sector isn't naturally comfortable in kind of speaking about kind of corporately.
Yeah, I mean, so I sort of agree with both DK and Marion. You know, at one level, this is a missed opportunity to have a grown-up debate, and the fact that somebody decided to sort of locate it in the culture walls is just deeply unhelpful because there's a serious and substantive issue that you know, universities need to engage with and wider society needs to engage with. And it's actually an issue that, you know, has profound consequences for social cohesion going forward, because, you know, we know from voting data and education attainment and what have you, that these divides run deep. So, you know, I just feel a bit like DK just said, this report is a massive missed opportunity, not necessarily in the issues that it's raising, but in its framing as a cultural issues. I do think universities need to engage in a different way around these issues of so-called white privilege and race and access. I think they, I think there's some brilliant practice out there, so it's very hard to speak in generalizations, but I do worry that there's a lot of what I in my book I call performative action, so, you know, symbolism, if you like, where we're doing stuff because we want to sort of show that we're doing stuff, rather than doing stuff that actually is going to make a difference to the outcomes of individuals. And you know, we're doing those performances partly in reaction to these cultural wars. So it's a very sort of negative circle that we need to break. But I think it's all too easy to walk away from the issues, and we need to you know, acknowledge that there are, you know, diverse segments of society that don't have access to higher education. And how we respond to that is probably very varied and very nuanced. But I would be nervous if we rejected this report because it's caught up in the cultural wars, and somewhat disappointed that the writers of the report decided that was the best way to frame it, because I think we're going to lose the opportunity to have a sensible discussion about these issues.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscription services. So thanks to Jonathan, Marin, TK and everyone at Team Wonky that makes the show happen behind the scenes. Until next week, stay wonky.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.